of Bed-Stuy. You're listening to We Love Radio.
Doing the yin and the yang, the hip and the hop, the stupid fresh thing, the flippity flop. Oh! I have today's forecast for you. Hot!
Don't worry, you're in the right place. No, Samuel Jackson is not sitting in as today's guest host. But in the clip you just heard, he was playing a radio DJ in Spike Lee's 1989 classic, Do the Right Thing, a film where the lead character is arguably the sweltering summer heat. Spike's unbearable heat is a lot like the scorching temperatures many Americans are enduring this week. Seriously, take a look at the high temperatures across the country and you'll see the U.S. map is redder than election night 1984. Sorry, that's a little electoral college weather joke. But this heat wave is not funny. I know for most of us, the heat is simply an irritation or an inconvenience. But for many others, it's deadly. A three-day heat wave has gripped the Pacific Northwest, parts of the East Coast, and Canada. And the results have turned deadly.
At least two deaths near Seattle are blamed on the record high temperatures. In Oregon, authorities say the heat may have claimed the life of a farm worker near Portland. North of the border in British Columbia, about 100 deaths are being linked to the heat wave. Emergency responders in Vancouver are stretched thin, with some people waiting hours for an ambulance.
This heat is oppressive in every sense, because some residents are far more vulnerable to the dire effects of heat. Let's go back 26 years to the summer of 1995. The city of Chicago experienced the deadliest heat wave in U.S. history, resulting in 739 deaths in just 1 week.
On July 13th of that year, the mercury rose to 106 degrees and for a week posted highs ranging from the upper 90s to the low 100s.
So many began to die that the deceased were stored in refrigerated trucks in the parking lot of the Cook County Morgue. The normal morgue facility simply couldn't handle this many deaths in so short a period of time.
Sound from the PBS documentary Chicago Tonight on the 1995 Chicago heat wave. As you can hear, these deaths were not evenly distributed across the city's residents or neighborhoods.
Well, the most likely to die were the elderly, first and foremost, and particularly the elderly poor, and even more specifically, poor elderly who lived alone.
The elderly and poor, 26 years ago, were most likely to die of Chicago's heat. The elderly and poor, 16 years ago, were most likely to die when Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. The elderly and poor, last year, they were the most likely to die during the Texas ice storms. The elderly and poor continue to bear the brunt of the global pandemic. Heat, ice, hurricane, virus. If all these natural disasters are claiming the same victims, maybe they aren't so natural. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is where we begin on The Takeaway. And to help us get a better understanding of the human-created disasters lurking beneath our natural disasters is Eric Kleinenberg, author of Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, and of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here, not for this reason, but good to hear your voice.
Always nice to talk with you, Eric. And because we have kind of an embarrassment of riches today, we are also joined by Kendra Pierre Lewis, who is senior climate reporter for the Gimlet Spotify podcast, How to Save a Planet. Kendra, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Now, I want to start with you, Kendra. Can you define for us what a heat wave is?
So in general, in the United States, a heat wave is basically considered 3 or more days of 90 degrees or warmer temperatures. So it's just heat. It's exactly what you think it is. It's several days of hot temperatures.
Now, are they getting worse or is it just kind of hot in summer?
They're getting worse. And actually one of the things that I think it, when we look at sort of what happened in the Pacific Northwest, when we look at what happened on the East Coast, where Boston hit 99 degrees, we very much look at these upper temperatures, 117, I think, in Washington State, 99 in Boston, as I mentioned. But we don't look at the lower temperatures, which is the overnight lows. And those are going up even faster than the daily highs. And those are what are catastrophic. Those are what are killing people. The body can, and you know, the elderly, young children, people on certain medications, they're more sensitive to heat. But in general, the human body can withstand a certain amount of heat. We're sort of built for some of this, but we need a break. And we're not getting that break because it's so hot in the night. And that's completely in line with climate projections. You know, cold things are warming faster than hot things. Nights are warming faster than days. Winter is warming faster than summer.
All right. So, Eric, I heard a little bit of a clue there potentially from Kendra about why it is the poor and the elderly, or at least certainly the elderly who might be most vulnerable in a heat wave. But you're the one who really has helped me think through this. Can you explain why some communities are so much more vulnerable than others?
Well, sure. The first thing is that, you know, unlike a hurricane or an earthquake, there's a very simple way for people to protect themselves during a heat wave if the power is working, and that's to turn on air conditioning, which the majority of Americans do. But it turns out not every American has access to air conditioning, and that access is patterned. So we see in poor communities, air conditioning is not available. And we also now increasingly see a number of places where the power grid is unable to keep up with contemporary demands. And so we have both the acute crisis of poverty and isolation that puts some people at risk, and we have this emerging crisis of climate change overwhelming the capacity of our infrastructure to protect us.
So is this as simple as kind of government providing low-cost air conditioning to people who don't currently have access to it?
I mean, in theory, if we had a reliable power grid and everyone could just turn on the air conditioning when they needed it, yes, you could reduce heat deaths. The problem, of course, is it's very difficult to do that. We've shown no political will to do that. And then the other thing is, if we rely on air conditioning to get through the heat, and the summers are getting hotter and hotter. I mean, I keep telling everyone what we're calling a heat wave is what our children are going to call summer. So we reach a point where we're using air conditioning all the time. That air conditioning is contributing to global warming. It's making things worse. So what I have been arguing is that fundamentally the heat wave just shows us how much vulnerability there is out there. It highlights inequalities that we work very hard not to see all the time. When we look at who's dying and where they're dying in heat crises or in hurricanes or in pandemics, we learn something fundamental about ourselves. And the burning question for me is not just how we deal with climate change, but also how we protect each other.
All right, Kendra, let's go to just that, right? So I think this tension is such a critical one. Like, okay, you know, imagine we suddenly had the political will and we could just hand out, you know, window units to everyone. Everyone would have at least one room that, you know, that was air conditioned. But then these other pieces of how that could have negative effects on the climate. So just pause and walk me through this a little bit. When we're looking at these current heat waves, what are the environmental factors that are currently contributing to making them worse? And is fixing it going to make it, fixing it for people going to make it even worse for the earth?
Yes, I feel like there are kind of three buckets that we can put it in. One is just climate change. We are dealing with the fallout of emissions that we have released into the atmosphere 10 to 20 years ago. And every day that we don't rein in emissions, it's going to get hotter and hotter. We're currently dealing with about 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming. The goal under the Paris Climate Agreement is to keep it to at least 2, ideally under 1.5. And every day that we delay in sort of enacting policies to kind of keep that threshold, we're kind of committing ourselves to an even hotter future. So there's that climate change bucket that sort of is making the present situation likely. And then there's sort of a broader infrastructure bucket, which is we know that cities, for example, are hotter than rural areas just because of the amount of concrete and just hardscaping that are baked into those areas. You can also look at traditional redlining maps to see that like communities of color are far less likely to have trees and shade cover, which provides some cooling. So there's this third element too, which is like, it's not just air conditioning. If you look at, you know, Seattle, which is arguably the least air-conditioned metro in the United States. So 56% of Seattle residents going into this heat wave did not have air conditioning. They also are in homes that aren't well insulated because for a long time, the Pacific Northwest didn't invest in insulation. So there are things that you can do, which is you can kind of run the AC for a while. Like I do this actually, I run the AC for a while and then I turn it off at the hottest time of the day because my air conditioning unit, whoever built my building was not very thoughtful and it just bakes in the sun and it doesn't work very well from 12 to 3. So rather than run it, I run it in the morning, get it cool in here, turn it off during the hottest part of the day when it's not working effectively anyway. And I can do that because my home is well insulated. So it keeps that cool air trapped inside for a while, right? If you don't have any insulation, the second your AC stops running, you start spewing that hot air out. And you're sort of seeing this kind of across the country that homes were not designed for the heat that we have. So there's this other bucket where we need to think through how do we construct our homes. It is kind of unhinged that there are, like, if you go into the South, that there are homes that are designed for New England that were constructed in the South. So without outside air conditioning, there's no way you're going to keep those homes cool. So there are ways that you can actually keep a space cool that aren't as dependent on conventional air conditioning, but we're not investing in those ways of building design. And then there's a third thing, which is that, like, all of this has a limit, right? Because we still need people to pick our produce. We still need construction workers. And if the summers continue getting this hot, and you're sort of seeing this already in Arizona, people are going to have to shift cycles. Like, people are going to have to start doing things at night that they used to do in the day because it's just too hot to go outside.
Listen, as a woman who lived in a shotgun home in New Orleans with 10-foot ceilings, I'm absolutely clear about your point about how construction can sort of meet the needs of the climate. And at the, you know, as you make the point about sort of what some of our workplaces are like, it also occurs to me that we are talking about homes and having a home or an apartment or a house as though that is a universal experience. So Eric, let me come to you on this as well. I just remember so distinctly from your text, Heat Wave, which, as you know, I've taught every chance I get, that part of the issue here also had to do with folks who were living in places that had maybe just one room, where people were actually afraid of crime on the street. So they were closing their windows instead of having them open for ventilation. How does that social infrastructure impact?
Well, the neighborhood environment matters. If you're in a physical place that gets very hot, or if you're in a neighborhood that kind of encourages people to hunker down at home as a survival strategy, you know, because there's a lot of crime, or if there's just not a lot of places to go, you know, that are social and protective, people get isolated. And the thing about the heat is it combines with our physical and social vulnerability to imperil some of us. And in disaster after disaster, we see the same pattern. It's the same neighborhoods. It's the same buildings. It's the same people. So that also goes to another question. If we know in advance who's at risk, why aren't we doing more as a society to take care of them?
Kendra, so for real, we're talking about wildfires now coming out of the drought and the heat. When we are looking at these compounding disasters like this, is there a way to prepare in advance? Should we be expecting this? And what can we do collectively to build some infrastructure around it?
Can I be honest for a second? I'm kind of losing my mind, I feel like, these days, because everyone's paying attention now because it's hot. And the second it gets cold again, people are going to stop paying attention. And yes, we should be preparing for these compounding disasters because they've already happened. Last year, Lake Charles got hit by multiple hurricanes. And in between the multiple hurricanes, it had to deal with a heat wave without electricity because electricity was out because of the hurricane. You know, last year in Central America, they got hit by Iota. And when in some communities that got hit by Hurricane Iota or Tropical Storm Iota were like, oh, you know, there isn't anything left to destroy because Eta, which hit us 2 weeks earlier, already destroyed everything. And so, yes, we should be preparing for compounding disasters. And some of that is infrastructure. Some of that is getting people out of harm's way. And, you know, a lot of that is reducing, and also a lot of that is reducing climate emissions, which the federal government continues to remain tacitly unwilling to do. The infrastructure budget just got slashed dramatically around its climate action. And everyone keeps kicking the bucket down the can. Kicking the can down the lane or whatever. And it's like, it's here. Like, we're literally dealing with the effects of it. And we're still not reining in emissions. We're still not doing the things. We're still not preparing in the ways that we need to prepare, because the second things get quote unquote closer to normal, we forget.
So I so appreciate your honesty and the intensity of this sense of like, no, for real, we have had this conversation before and we are losing people and we're, and it makes us feel like we're losing our minds. And so Eric, let me come to you on this, because part of what I notice when we get into the, you know, the hurricane season or into the wildfire season, or we start seeing the droughts, is when we talk about disaster preparedness, it is very individualized. Like, do you and your family have a plan, right? Do you have a backup generator? It's like, just you, how are you going to fix this? Is there a way that we can collectively, collaboratively, socially prepare for disaster rather than expecting each individual and household to do so?
Well, we have to, because as we all can see, this is not a problem that individuals can solve. And so now we move from the realm of weather and society to the domain of politics. And someone asked me this week on Twitter, you know, what can you do to help people during this moment? And I said, the way to help people right now, this week, when there's searing heat, is to check in on people who are close to you, whether that's physically close or socially close, and scream for everyone in your community to do the same. But what we do long-term is everything in the political sphere to elect officials who are going to take global warming seriously, to work in our communities to make sure that we have a collective plan to look after each other, to push for new kinds of energy, renewable energy, and to make sure that we don't think that this is all about, you know, what one mayor does or what one governor does, how they perform in an individual event. This is now the new normal. We will deal with weather like this for the rest of our lives because we're in a new climate. And the only way that we can address it is to rebuild.
So now I feel really sad, because Eric, for you to bring us to the land of politics as a place where potentially we could do collective and collaborative work feels like nearly impossible right now in this moment, where we are so likely to see each other as the enemy across ideological or partisan differences, when there is so little trust in the government. Is the first piece of infrastructure building actually figuring out how to trust each other and trust the processes we have for making collective decisions, like science and government?
Melissa, I don't think that we fix this ideologically. I don't think we'll have a debate where someone will articulate a position that's so compelling that everyone on the left and the right and the blue and the red will come together. I think we fix this by making things, by solving problems. And so I share your cynicism. This is a horrible time for divisive and violent partisan politics in the United States. It feels as if we are just at the edge of having everything fall apart. But we are also at the beginning of a rebuilding process. What's happening with a kind of infrastructure campaign, the public programs that we are building, give us what I think is the most exciting opportunity in my lifetime to create something that's fundamentally different, to get off the track that we've been on for decades. I'm not saying it's going to happen, Melissa. I'm not that glib or naive, but I think this is the fight of our lives. And our success depends on our capacity to link these overlapping crises, you know, the climate emergency, the COVID emergency, the racial justice crisis, the inequality crisis, to this project of rebuilding. They are wrapped up in each other. And if we don't engage them fully now, we will miss the chance of our lives.
Kendra, is that conversation about social and racial injustice and inequality infused now in the climate conversation? Because for many years, they felt like they were separate.
I definitely think it's a bigger part of the climate conversation. And something I want to piggyback on what Eric said is that this doesn't only have to happen on the federal level. This is also on the state and the local and the regional level. Like these things that need to get changed, like you can pick the levels at where you get engaged. And on those scales in particular, and even within the Biden administration, racial justice is interwoven with this, economic justice is interwoven with this. These are conversations that the climate movement at large is having. Whether or not it's effective is a broader conversation, but they are definitely raising this issue.
Kendra Pierre-Lewis is senior climate reporter for the Gimlet Spotify podcast, How to Save a Planet. And Eric Kleinenberg is author of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Sharon Rube. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. And I'm calling to let you know how the heat has affected us here. A lot of our plants were very droopy. It was very hot. Our air conditioning had to work overtime. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, hi, this is Kelly. I'm calling from Newburgh, Oregon. The heat wave impact on us, I think, is more emotional than anything else. I had to bring the animals in because I was a little worried about them in the heat. But more than anything, it just made me kind of grumpy. So I've had to be more aware of my interactions with family and others and how the slowly rising heat you don't notice until suddenly you're grumpy. Thank you so much. That's my takeaway.
Hi, this is Lori with Bend, Oregon. And what am I concerned about in terms of the heat? How about water, fires, air quality? Something we contend with every year, but this year just seems like we're starting off pretty poorly. Thank you.
This is Amber calling from Nashua, New Hampshire, and I love the heat. I let all my coworkers know that I'm a perspirer, but I work in a hospital, and all the patients are having a hard time because it's hot, and a lot of the bubblers are turned off because of COVID.
I'm Kate from Portland, Oregon, and this heat wave has not just been bad for our health living in the Pacific Northwest, but also for our mental health. I know a lot of people are really struggling with thinking about the future and the impact of climate change, and I am definitely not the only one who is going through a mentally dark period, just worried about the future.
Hi, the heat wave was really pretty bad here on Monday. It was over 115 degrees. And it reminded me when I lived in Arizona because the humidity was just wrung out of the air. So it was really low humidity, but we didn't have any problem. There were no power shortages or blackouts. Things went well. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm Brian. Thank you.
This is Dunya from Portland, Oregon. I think this weekend really brought about the disparity in our populations, and especially how few services there are for our houseless community. We really had to rely on nonprofits and volunteers and people pulling together to make sure that people had shade, people had water and what they needed in order to survive. We didn't have Red Cross here, and it didn't seem like we had a lot of effort from the city itself. So really brought to light once again how we're failing our houseless community. Thank you.
In 2018, Bill Cosby, who was then 81, was convicted on 3 felony counts of aggravated indecent assault and sentenced to serve at least 3 years and up to 10 years in prison. In May of 2021, Cosby was denied parole, due in part to his refusal to participate in a program for sexually violent offenders. On Wednesday, Bill Cosby was released from prison after the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania overturned his conviction due to a procedural issue. Joining me now is Jamie Floyd, senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit at New York Public Radio. Jamie, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Melissa.
So, how did this happen?
Well, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, as you say, sided with Bill Cosby and his attorneys in an argument they've been making throughout both criminal trials he went through and the appeals, which is that a former district attorney in the county where he has a home and where this alleged assault took place had made a promise to Bill Cosby that he would not be prosecuted if he agreed to participate in some other civil litigation, because civil litigation is obviously doesn't land you in jail. And Cosby believed that was binding. So after the promise was made And when Andrea Constant's allegations first came to light, he did go on to give sworn testimony in a civil trial, and he incriminated himself. He said things that were damaging, deeply damaging, in the criminal context. Things like he would sometimes give drugs to women that he wanted to have sex with. He claimed that he only shared that information because he never thought he'd be charged in the criminal context. And the justices said, Melissa, that these promises should have been kept. And it's not an acquittal. They're not saying that Bill Cosby is innocent. This is critically important to say because the victims here are devastated. But it's also not a technicality. You were right to call it a procedural issue. You have a Fifth Amendment right in this country not to incriminate yourself in the criminal context. And it is inviolable. It's one of the ones we hold most dear, right? That's why you get a Miranda warning, all of that kind of thing. And here he spoke against his interest in court. He gave testimony under oath, believing that the prosecutor would honor the promise. And when he did that, it was a violation, the court said, of that Fifth Amendment right. So it's not a substantive acquittal, but it's more than a technicality. They are sending a signal to prosecutors. Hmm. Don't make promises you're not going to keep.
I want to just go into that one more step because, you know, I'm a survivor. I know not only for survivors, but for so many of us, we saw this moment and it feels like such an injustice. But I'm also someone deeply committed to criminal justice reform and real criminal justice. And so on the procedural account, if we can take the Bill Cosby out of it, right, it actually does matter to have that Fifth Amendment right protected. And if a prosecutor makes that promise, to have that be binding, it would be deeply troubling in the long term for that not to be binding.
Right. And I think this is why talking about the Cosby case matters. It's not because he's a big celebrity, but the reason it matters is for the reasons you just stated. We have victims here who allege horrific things happened to them, and the system they feel is failing them. But as you point out, there are so many black and brown men in prison who have intersected with the criminal justice system in ways that have failed them. And so prosecutors cannot make promises to the counsel for criminal defendants and then not honor those promises. And we certainly have to honor the Fourth Amendment search and seizure requirements and the Fifth Amendment right to not testify against yourself, right against self-incrimination. And when prosecutors, again, make promises, they have to keep them. And what happened here, just to be clear, Melissa, is the first prosecutor made the promise. The Bill Cosby case actually predates the Me Too movement, as many people will remember. The movement happens, and then a new prosecutor comes in, and he says, well, I am not going to live by this. In the midst of this movement, we must honor these women, and wants to, with noble intentions, prosecute Bill Cosby. But the court said, no, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has to honor its promises to those whom it is prosecuting.
Ooh, Jamie Floyd is the senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit at New York Public Radio and is helping us to walk through the differences between law and justice and fairness and what feels good and what feels right and what just has to be. And Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Listening to The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now, we're just a few days from our big national birthday celebration, the 4th of July. And I've been thinking about some of the genuinely amazing rights we enjoy in this country. the right to speak our minds when we want to, the right to remain silent when we need to, the right to a speedy trial, and the right to be judged by our peers. But there is a right we don't enjoy, one that we're denied. Well, hey, wait, Jay, did the player break? You see, one of the rights that we are cut off from, shut out of, we do not have the right to repair our broken stuff. Now, if you're anything like me, you didn't even know that you were being denied this right. Like, but straight up, no joke, thank goodness for the reporting team here at The Takeaway, because without their intervention, I would not have even thought about this issue. But it turns out it's kind of a big deal. All right, let's say you break your smartphone, something I might have done once, okay, twice. Well, there's also that time it fell off the balcony. Oh, okay, so like five times. But nearly every time I had to make an appointment with the retailer, wait in line, and either pay for a really costly fix or shell out for a new device. What if it didn't have to be that way? For years, right to repair advocates have been pushing for laws that provide consumers and independent repair shops with access to the information, parts, and tools required to fix products like iPhones and more.
Computers, laptops, tablets, PDAs, any kind of home telephone system, home electronics, consumer electronics, TVs, household appliances, small appliances, large appliances, tractors. My name is Gay Gordon Byrne. I'm the executive director of the Digital Right to Repair Coalition, much more easily known as repair.org.
Organizations like the Repair Association have been instrumental in getting right to repair legislation introduced at the statewide level. And the movement's finally gaining traction at the national level too. In June, federal legislation called the Fair Repair Act was introduced in Congress. Getting that passed would be a big step, according to advocates like Gordon Brine.
It's actually not so much about self-repair as it is about making sure that anybody that wants to fix something has the opportunity to do it. If you as a consumer want to fix your stuff, you can, but it's much more important that a small business be able to know that they can get the parts and the tools and the service documentation that they need to offer the service.
After learning about all of this, I was pretty convinced that right to repair is important, but I wanted to understand more. So I made a call to the first person I could think of.
My name is Shalisha Morgan, owner and founder of Geek & Hills Cell Phone and Computer Repair, based out of Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Now, y'all got to understand that after I met Shalisha, I started handing over all of my repairs to this Geek & Hills. Here's why.
At my business, I charge $49.99 for an iPhone 6 repair. If a client were to take their phone to the Apple store, Apple would charge them $129 for that very same repair. This is absurd. Just as consumers have the right to take their cars to any dealership or mechanic to have it repaired, we all should have the very same right to do so with our devices. Post-COVID, families are still scraping to get by. Every single dime counts. I had to turn away a client yesterday who wanted to have their cracked TV screen fixed. Why? I literally could not locate the parts anywhere. Manufacturers are making these devices throwaway devices, causing us, the consumers, to have to go back out and buy them and replace them again. Girl, Apple, bye.
We've been talking about the right to repair movement in the U.S., and I have Matthew Galt, staff writer at Vice's Motherboard, with me. Good morning, Matthew.
Hi, thank you so much. So wonderful to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about why there's been an increased interest and momentum surrounding this?
Everyone has a cell phone that's broken that they couldn't get repaired. Everyone's broken a laptop. And then over the course of the pandemic, I think we all came to rely so heavily on this stuff. So many people working from home, buying new computers. Inevitably, people had things break and then couldn't get them repaired. Not only couldn't find a repair shop that would take them, but also found that, you know, Apple had closed down his Genius Bars, and that even if they could get in there and make the repairs themselves, they didn't have the tools and the knowledge wasn't anywhere on the internet.
You know, this is precisely what happened to me. I was, you know, trying to set up my, you know, quarantine home office, was moving my desk around, and boop, my, you know, desktop fell off the desk. And it was right at the height, right? And all the Apple stores and Genius bars were closed. And it was like, sort of, where do we go now? What do we do next? So let's talk about that Fair Repair Act, which was recently introduced in Congress. What would this legislation do?
This would, it's very similar to other legislation that's passed in like Massachusetts around cars, where it makes it so that the manufacturer has to share very basic things with anyone else who wants to make a repair. Now, that could be an independent repair shop owner. It could be an individual who wants to make the repair. But they're calling for, like, say, if you break your iPhone, then Apple would have to provide you with the tools and the diagnostics and, like, any manuals that it had that would allow you to easily, say, replace the screen on your phone or the case if you shattered it. And it has a provision that allows the FCC to fine companies that are not compliant. And it's really kind of that simple.
And does this not run afoul of intellectual property rights?
That is one of the big arguments and big pushbacks from companies like Apple. And there is a carve out in the bill that says anything that involves trade secrets does not have to be shared. But I think you start getting into this tricky situation here where smarter people than me have already figured out how to go in and open up an iPhone and repair it and could replace a screen with an aftermarket screen that's much cheaper than Apple would charge through its Genius Bar or another one of its authorized repair techs, right? The problem comes, and this has actually happened, where people have gotten their screens replaced with aftermarket screens that were much cheaper. And then a few months down the line, Apple pushes in a software update, and then suddenly the touch function on those screens doesn't work. These right to repair laws are meant to prevent companies from like Apple from stopping people from just getting their stuff repaired, frankly, wherever they want to, or doing the repairs themselves.
So these days, I can no longer tell what is going to be a partisan issue, right? Things that I wouldn't expect to be partisan turn out to be. So what about the right to repair? Is this bipartisan in nature, or has this become ideological in any way?
It really hasn't become ideological in any way. Obviously, you have lobbyists on Apple and John Deere. We can get into farm equipment later, who are pushing against this. But this is one of those things where everybody has an iPhone. Everyone's got a computer or laptop or knows someone that has been affected by this. Everyone has busted a phone and taken it in to get repaired to the manufacturer, and they're going to charge them $400 or just ask them to replace the phone, right? When in reality, if they still had one of those little mom and pop shops that could do the repair, they could get it replaced, for $50 and go on about their day. And because of the ubiquity of our technology, I think everyone, when you explain it to them, when they really get it, it makes sense.
We've all broken a phone, but we haven't all broken a combine. Can we go back to the farm equipment issue? What's going on with farm equipment?
So this one, I think, is another one of the reasons that this is so bipartisan and people really understand it is because this is affecting farmers. For hundreds of years, farmers have used tractors and they've generally repaired their own equipment or they've had someone in their community that does all the repairs, right? And it's been, the system has worked fine. Well, as technology has advanced, companies like John Deere's kind of one of the big drivers of this, have added onboard computers and GPS systems and all this fancy tech to the tractors. And the way they work now is if something goes wrong in the computer system of the tractor, it'll start throwing an error code. And an authorized John Deere tech has to come out there and clear that error code before any repairs can be made on the vehicle. Even if it's a repair that the farmer knows how to do, if they don't have the specialized piece of equipment that allows them to clear that error code, they can't fix the combine or the tractor. And this has led to this really bizarre aftermarket where you've got farmers trying to buy tractors that were manufactured before the onboard electronics started being put on them, because they know they'll pay double what it cost in the 1970s to get one, but then they know it's going to run for another 50 years and they aren't going to have to jack with all the computer stuff.
Right, because what we should be doing is definitely making life harder for farmers.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I get now on this sense. Now, what else? So we've got phones, we've got combines and tractors. Let me just say, I recently threw away what felt to me like a completely brand new vacuum because it ceased working. And I was just sort of recalling, growing up as a kid, there was a vacuum repair place in our community. There doesn't seem to be one now. Is it all of these other small electronics as well?
Yeah, it is. All these things have computer systems in them now that make it hard for people to access without a little bit of knowledge of how the electronic systems work. The big one for me, and again, another reason I think that this blew up so big during the pandemic, is medical equipment. So there were ventilators during the pandemic that needed repairs. There were not enough ventilators to go around. There certainly weren't enough repair techs to go around. And the ventilator manufacturers, they wanted authorized repair techs to do the fixes on these machines. And the hospitals, you know, these simple fixes that they could have done, they, you know, they kind of had to put them by the wayside. And it's not just ventilators. There's some great testimony out of Colorado where they're trying to get similar legislation passed. You had people that had medical devices they were using for mobility or to survive, sharing their stories about living in rural parts of Colorado. One gentleman had a wheelchair that had ceased functioning, and he had someone in his local area that could make the fix, but the people who provided him the wheelchair said, no, we need to send out our repair tech to do it, or you'll void your warranty and we'll never work on the chair again. And he ended up waiting 4 weeks before someone could come out and see his chair. And there were several stories like that.
Matthew Galt is a staff writer at Vice's Motherboard, and I think he might have just turned me into like the Paul Revere of the right to repair. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. And if you receive this invitation from someone you only met a day ago...
Hey. Last month, I went dancing at this cute spot in Florida where my roommate's girl made like 5 G's a night. My roommate just told me that he going out there tomorrow, and he asked me if I had any friends that want to make some money, and you the first I thought of.
Well, you should probably go ahead and say, thanks, but no thanks. That's at least one of the conclusions readers were able to draw from the uber-viral 2015 Twitter thread by Asia King, who goes by Zola. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with that thread, let's just say the trip to Florida did not go as planned, and the roommate you heard mentioned in that clip was actually a pimp who tried to force Zola to engage in sex work. Now, this week, a movie adaptation of the Twitter thread entitled Zola is out in theaters. Directed by Janixa Bravo and starring Taylor Page as Zola, this movie captures the original thread in all its absurdity and horror. One of the film's biggest surprises is character actor Coleman Domingo as the so-called roommate. Now you might know Domingo and his typically warm presence from movies including If Beale Street Could Talk and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But in this role, he's capturing something much more sinister.
I think that I've been in the canon of very sort of loving Black fathers and men and advisors, you name it. And I think this is going to be a real swing for people to see me in this role. What did you think? Am I terrifying you?
And to be honest, even though he's kind of ridiculously charming in real life, after watching the movie, I was kind of terrified to talk with him. I spoke with Domingo about why he took Bravo up on her offer to play this intimidating role.
It's fun, but it's also an incredible challenge. What I thought was, to be very honest, even when Janixa asked me to play that role, I just thought, well, what has she seen that would even remotely make her think of me for this role? And I guess, you know, I think that she knows that I'm a character actor through and through, but also that I wanted to humanize this character. So I think that was a huge challenge, like to humanize a character that you know does awful, degrading things, to especially to women. And I don't know, to find something about him that's charming, that is loving, and I don't know. So I thought that was a great challenge for me. So there was anything like that is a fun challenge where I'm like, okay, I have to go into the heart of some darkness, but also find out what makes them tick and what makes them human. And so that's what I thought the undertaking was. So I don't know. I wanted to find out what was his dreams, what did he want. Once I found out he was also Nigerian, I was like, oh, okay, I can look at it from the point of view as an immigrant story. And maybe this is what he has to have agency in the world. And he wants what everyone else wants. This is just his access point. He has no other way of attaining the American dream, but he wants it like everyone else. So that's the only way to make him human. And because otherwise, if I judged him from the outside or as he is in the story or as pretty much he was as a human being, I would think not the best things about him.
But I can see your point about the access into his humanity through the immigrant story, because it's the moment when he asks everyone to say his name and ensures that his name is said and is said well and is said right. And I thought, you helped me to see what's in that moment.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think he wants to be acknowledged. He wants what everyone else wants. And he's like, I'm sure he said, I've told you my name before again and again, and no one can ever say it. Think about that. I know that I'm always very particular about how people always put an E in my name. And I'm just like, you know, that's not my name. And that's, you know, not to sound like, you know, Tina Turner, where you're like, all I have is my name. You know?
But it is true. And in fact, the producers may be laughing as they listen along, because it is both one of the greatest challenges that I have as a monolinguistic speaker who only speaks English, but also wants to have, you know, diversity in our show. And I'm always like, I will go to bed repeating the names of my guests, trying to be sure I get them right, and will still get them wrong, because, you know, the American tongue is fat and lazy and a little bit pitiful on these things.
You said it. That's the truth. Well, it's like we don't usually have to think about it. You know, I mean, we're dealing with Bobs and Michaels and Johns. We don't have to really deal with, you know, I personally, when I went to Amsterdam for the first time, I was so confused just even looking at, you know, names of streets. I was like, okay, because we don't usually have that in our language, you know, so I get it. I'm a lazy American too.
So talk to me about, because one of the places that can be most lazy is Hollywood, particularly in its representation of Black folk. So talk to me about what you are looking for in a script, in a character.
Oh, well, what a wonderful question. I think I'm always just looking at complexity. I wanted to look at a character that is... that is flawed. They don't have to be just and good people. I think that people are very complex. And I think one minute they say one thing and then they mean another. I'm looking for complexity, especially when it comes to the canon of African-American men that I've played or will play. I never want to do this sort of the easy version of it. You can see that pretty quickly in a script. And the blessing is I've been on this show, Fear the Walking Dead, for 7 seasons now. And my showrunners really listen to me because they know that I'm just really trying to look at the complexities of a character and for him to never be monolithic, for him to be daring and to not just be, a morally genuine, loving, kind person. I'm like, nah, there's all shades of gray. And don't be afraid of that because I'm African-American. But lean into the complexities of a man. So I'm always just looking for that with any script, to be honest. With any script that I look for, I look for something that'll scare me, to be honest. Something that I have not played before. Something that I think will change me, will also move me, and help me see someone else's point of view. That's what's interesting to me. Instead of sort of like a rehashing, you can see it pretty quickly when you see a rehashing of something that they want. For a minute, I honestly thought that people were trying to turn me into, not to say anything against this wonderful, wonderful, legendary actor, but, you know, sort of that voice of God, that Morgan Freeman. People get obsessed with that. You have a great voice, Coleman. You're a soothing presence. You're, in a way, sometimes I feel like non-threatening. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that, so I sort of push against that and sort of make choices to make sure that they're a very complex human being, you know?
Well, Zola will help with you being non-threatening. I think that, that will assist.
It's a good, gentle assist. I think that's great. You know, I think a character like X, I think in the hands of another actor sometimes could have just been set up as a trope. He could just, you know, you can just get obsessed with being the villain and playing all the dark notes of this character and not humanizing him. And I thought that that's, you know, I've seen those tropes of, you know, pimps and thugs and hood dudes who are just trying to get by and make some money and do terrible things. But I thought like, oh, there's more notes to that. And I think that will shine a light on who we are as human beings and make sure that we're more, we can see each other. I can see something of myself in X. And I think any brother who thinks, oh, I have nothing to do with this guy, you can see that he has wants and needs like anybody else.
Can you say a little bit more? I was intrigued when you said, my showrunners listen to me. Last week, we had a conversation about Hollywood and about writers' rooms and about how frequently folks are actually not listened to, are ignored, or are just put into a single category. You know, you've been on the show for a while. Did that listening happen over time, or is that kind of the culture of that space?
You know what? I think our showrunners, I think I've been very blessed with, it started out with Dave Erickson, who really wrote to my strengths. He created this character. Specifically, I don't think that he was meant for an African-American actor. He seemed like he was straight out of Shakespeare. He was like Richard III, and I love language. And I just sort of like came in with that love and passion for it. And then he wrote towards me in many ways. I think a good, smart showrunner will see, we'll get to know their cast and see where their strengths are and where their weaknesses are and sort of write towards or challenge those things. And so in every single way, in shape and form, I wanted to make sure that they knew that, yes, Victor Strand is a character that may not specifically have been written as a Black man, but I am a Black man. And his Blackness will have to be a part of it in some way. I know that, to be very honest, I know even like in season 6, my wardrobe supervisor started to notice that my character, I was sort of like bring his hat to the side just a little bit at times. I said, well, that's the way he wears his hat. It's not just straight up on his head. I said, he's making a statement about his identity. So he cocks it a little to his side. His roots are from the East Coast and from, you know, urban America. And I'm like, we need to see some of that sometimes. And they're not afraid of it, which is great. I think I'm sure they don't lean into it in the beginning, but I sort of have to do my work and sort of like be a collaborator in that way. I think as long as there's a forum where you can, speak your truth and question the process. And my showrunners have been very open. I mean, you know, they hand me the pen at times and say, what do you think it is? I say, well, I think he has to say this and it has to be about that. And they listen and they incorporate my notes and thoughts. And I think that's what my responsibility is as an actor as well. That I come from the theater. So it means you give over everything. I don't need writing credit. I don't need any sort of credits. I'm like, what it is, we're trying to make the sausage together. You know what I mean? And we need everyone's hands on deck. So I've been listened to, which is great. But also I think I even teach this. I know how to raise a question or collaborate without it feeling like I'm imposing. I feel like they know that I'm coming from a place of love and generosity, and I'm just trying to make it the best that it can be. And they hear it as such, you know? The people who don't hear it, I think, have some ego issues. And luckily, I haven't had that on my set, you know?
It is one of my favorite things about being in any aspect of media is that collaborative production, right? That you talk about theater there, and there's that sense, okay, the audience sees the actors on stage or maybe on screen, but that's the tip of the iceberg, right? Most of it is actually happening beyond the purview of the audience.
Absolutely. It's all happening in the purview of the audience. I think that's where I have my most joy, to be honest, is when we're creating the thing before anyone else sees it. And we're wrestling with language, we're wrestling with character, every costume detail. You're giving up, you give over everything to it without wanting credit for it. Because you're like, it doesn't matter to me who came up with that moment or that idea. It is just you absorb it all and then you perform it. And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Now, you have another film that is on the horizon that, again, might help with this non-threatening situation. You're starring in the upcoming Candyman movie. Can you talk to me a little bit about this?
I can. A recent trailer just came out, and I think it's phenomenal because it really centers on the story of Candyman. And you can tell with my voiceover that my character sort of... I don't know, he's sort of like, you know, holding up the story and the legend of Candyman. So my character was written for me by Jordan Peele. And he wanted me to be this neighborhood guy who sort of, I think, who holds the trauma of the neighborhood in some way. I think he's just raising questions of, like, you know, of gentrification, of people coming in and not understanding all the things that have went down in the neighborhood. And basically sort of saying, you know, you can come. I know this location is sexy and wonderful and you want it now, but you can't just have the location without having the trauma as well. That's important for gentrification. I think that's what he's saying. So I think that's saying something without saying everything, but I think that's sort of the impulse of my character.
I find Jordan Peele's mind, at least as it's presented through his films, to be brilliant and completely terrifying. And yeah. I'm wondering about, you've had this opportunity to work with really eclectic Black directors, some of the best in the business. Tell me a little bit about what those collaborations have been like for you.
You know what they are? They are really, I'm just thinking, the moment you said that, I thought of Jenixa Bravo, Nia DaCosta, you know, these people who are saying, Coleman, we want what you bring and we want you to help challenge this as well. And they're not afraid of my mind as well. Because when I come onto any project, people know that you're going to get a dramaturg, you're going to get a full collaborator. I'm not just going to hit my marks and just say the lines, but I'm going to help question and wrestle with this to make it the best that it can be. I'm going to use every skill that I have, because that's what I've always believed that's what was required. So I think, I don't know, it feels like you can make some magic and you feel like you can challenge the way we're represented on film. That's what I think. I get that with, you know, even like, you know, with more senior directors like George C. Wolfe. George is the director who's been doing this for so many years. But when I tell you, he gets down on the floor and he's sort of playing with clay and he's always willing to challenge and wrestle and really, elevate. But also not be afraid to be guttural with our experience as well, that we are all things, that we are not just one, but we're not just Cosby's and we're not just Good Times, but we're all of it in between, you know?
When I think of us being all things, I just want to return to this really lovely GQ profile from earlier in the year, detailing how you fell in love with your husband and how you first saw each other at a Walgreens and then, you know, found each other through the Craigslist missed connections posters. Like, right? This is not normally how this goes down.
No.
So I want to know, is this going to be a film? Are we going to get to watch this someday on the screen?
The funny thing is after we had this chance meeting 17 years ago, I actually wrote about it. I wrote a short story about it. And it was called something like Two Birds, One with Green Eyes, One with Open Hands. Because there were some significant things that happened on our first date. And I thought of him as a bird. And a bird with open hands. Because when he sat down, I noticed that he didn't sit with his hands on his palms down. He sat with his palms up. And it was the first time I've ever seen anybody do that. And I thought, look at that. That's a real open human being. He's so open to the world. I don't know if it'll be...
It's a revolutionary position, palms up, because it means you can't be typing on a keyboard. You can't be, you know, laboring in a particular way. It's a very yogic position.
I think so. And it's something that I was so taken with him. And he really, I mean, I think that we've, honestly, the way we met truly was magic. I do believe that the divine resides. I believe there's magic and you just have to look for it. And I know that that's how I got the love of my life. We met, like I said, it was a chance meeting and then a follow-up on a Craigslist missed connections when I wasn't, neither, he placed the ad and 2 hours later I found it, but I was looking for a used computer. And then I just went to that. Yeah, and then I just went to that profile, that site, because I thought, I wonder, I can't stop thinking about this interaction. And then he posted an ad for me. And then we met up 2 days later. I told him I loved him that night. And we've been together for 17 years now. And so that's the thing that I know when people are like, did that really happen? I'm like, yeah, it did. But I do believe, I am one of those people that believe in magic. I really do. I believe that there's love. Love is available. You just have to have your eyes open. You can't be on a computer screen. You got to be out with your heart open. And that's the only way it happens. That's what I think.
Your heart open and maybe your hands open as well. Thank you for that beautiful story.
You're welcome, Melissa.
Coleman Domingo is one of the stars of Zola, and you have not seen him like this before. It's in theaters this week. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, that's the show, y'all. It's not quite the weekend, so be sure to tune back in tomorrow for more with me. And of course, call us with your show ideas and suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.